The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing for men, we have a way of helping prevent bladder cancer. What's in a grapefruit that makes it so wonderful? I'll tell you. Also, ways that we can stay healthy in our work environment. And vitamins and minerals actually lower the risk of death. This is the newest study. This is a legitimate study, not the ones that we see that are pharmaceutically based. Also, the latest on how religion, any religion, or a spiritual support group facing illness can help you live longer. So that's important, and I'll deal with that. From our social calendar today, we're going to give you the story of a very dedicated, highly educated, completely motivated person in Greece. But what happens when there's no jobs? That Greece will go into complete meltdown, social anarchy, extreme violence, burning of the buildings, overthrow of the government, and going off the euro, and then holding those accountable who got them into this mess after that. Today, before you take your flu shot, better understand the government is now saying that, well, it's not as effective as what we have been telling. The Lancet Infectious Disease Journal gives you the latest on that. Guest today will be Professor Roderick Tremblay. He is a prominent economist. He is Professor Emeritus at the University of Montreal, and he was also former Minister of Industry and Commerce in Quebec in the government. And so we're going to talk with him about the push for austerity measures in the United States, Obama's super committee, and the evidence of austerity failures in Europe, all related to growing inequality and the rise of a new class warfare system. So we have a lot to share, and I will be opening this up for calls and input as we go through our program. So let's begin. First, something we can all do, we can drink more fluids. And for men in particular, according to the newest study that was the American Association for Cancer Research, you could lower your risk of bladder cancer. A lot of men who drink beer develop bladder cancer. And I remember growing up in West Virginia, on Saturdays, people went to a tavern. And at the tavern, they talked, watched ball games, and they drank beer and they ate a fried fish. A little catfish or other fish came out of the Kanawha River, and they battered up and salted up. And that's what they ate all day long, all Saturday, all Sunday. And they all had pot bellies. And from my perspective, I thought it was interesting because the people would all tell these stories. And the moment someone would start to tell a story, everyone in the place would become just silent. There would be this hush over everything. And this person would go into great detail about maybe how they caught a football and won a game. It was always something athletic. And these people were probably in their late 20s, 30s, or 40s. And I asked my dad, I said, why do they keep telling the same stories over and over? And why does everybody act like this the first time they're hearing this when it's the 100th time? And he said, well, Gary, he said, in their lifetime, will they do that was so remarkable that that's what they have to acknowledge themselves. That was their defining moment, something heroic. If it's an older generation, meaning his generation, it was about what they did in the armed forces in the Second World War or the Korean War that showed that, you know, they were willing to sacrifice their life for buddies or something. And he said, so if that's what you have to define your life, then you're going to pay attention to everyone else because you're sharing this commonality. I just thought it was so interesting because I would find it so true, because for the rest of their lives, they never did anything. I wouldn't say they didn't do anything. That's not incorrect. There were no more remarkable moments. From then on, they just lived as society dictated, and they had their families and were at their jobs and retired, etc. But all the while I'm watching this in this little tavern, it's called the Red Tavern, in the back all the teenagers went to shoot pool, so we'd shoot pool. We're all good pool shooters. But in the front would be the older guys, older, you know, we were 16, 15, 17, 18, would be the older guys, and they'd be watching the ball games. They all had pot bellies because no one exercised. You weren't supposed to exercise. You were not encouraged to exercise. I actually remember running across the Belfry Bridge when I went out one day because I was lifting weights and I had a weight in each hand and I was running and I was doing heavy-duty weightlifting. I was doing bodybuilding. I was about 238 pounds, all muscle, 28-inch waist. And there were five of us that worked out together doing powerlifting in this makeshift garage. There was no YMCA. There was no gym. We didn't have any of that. And the cop stopped and says, what are you doing? The guy shines a light on me, and I said, I'm running. Running from what? No, I'm just out running. Why are you running? And I said, well, it's exercise. I read in this article that if you run with weights in your hand, these are 20-pound dumbbells, you get stronger. Well, that's kind of strange, isn't it? I said, well, I'm getting stronger, so it's working for me. Well, maybe you ought to not be running over this bridge. The bridge connected West Virginia with Ohio. And I said, okay. And I, you know, finished my run. And I just thought it strange that someone would stop you because so few people ever ran anywhere that just out going for a jog was considered odd. In any case, the amount of alcohol allowed in the beer at that time was 2.3% and very small amount of alcohol. But studies would then come out showing that men who had beer bellies also had the highest rate of bladder cancer. And I could see guys put away 10, 15 bottles of beer in an afternoon because it was pretty much like water with a little alcohol, but that little alcohol was enough to influence bladder cancer because it causes, as we know now, alcohol destroys cells, heart cells, brain cells, eye cells. And then on top of that, they all smoked. So then everybody was always squinting and smoke and their hair was always kind of straw looking like. And they always had these ruddy complexions and stains on their teeth, stains on their hands because everyone smoked. Everyone in my family except myself smoked. And they thought it was normal because everyone else smoked and everyone drank beer. Now we look back and we understand why three generations died early. They didn't have to. But there was going to be no option when you look at all that in you. So how can we stop the bladder cancer and the prostate cancer in men today? Drinking the beer. How about that? Because even though you're not going to drink a whole lot to get drunk because it's low alcohol, you're really hurting your bladder and you're hurting your prostate gland. Right now in almost every health food store in the United States, you can find no alcohol beers. It gives you the taste of the beer, but it's natural ingredients and it's not going to cause any damage. But for everyone else that wants to prevent breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, and bladder cancer, big cancers in men and women, drink juices each day. Drink clean water. That's not the water out of a New York City tap. Here's the latest on this. Quote, men who drink plenty of fluids may reduce their risk of bladder cancer. Well, fluids would be water, not coffee. This was done at Brown University. So here's my suggestion. Start the day with a glass of apple, celery, and lemon juice, and put a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar and raw honey in it. If you want the best honey, it's Tupelo honey from the Tupelo blossom down in Louisiana and Mississippi. Also in Central Florida. That's where you get your Tupelos. There's some extraordinary ingredients in there that can help your body. It creates a more alkaline state. It helps with digestion. It helps to deacidify the system. Helps you if you have pains. Cleanses the liver and cleanses the bloodstream. Later in the day, have a darker juice. Let's have a berry juice. Raspberries, black raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, pomegranate. That's a great juice to have. Low in sugar, low glycemic, but very loaded with phytonutrients. And the phytonutrients that are red help repair your DNA. So anytime you're taking red, you're repairing your DNA, slowing down the aging process, reversing prematurely aged organs, making them younger again, literally turning the sand clock upside down and starting it over. Because you're lengthening the telomeres instead of shortening them. The alcohol, the caffeine, the soft drinks shorten the telomeres on the chromosomes, speeding up the aging process. What I'm saying lengthens the telomeres and allows you to live a longer life. Then in mid-afternoon, have yourself an herbal tea. Now, it doesn't matter what the base of the tea is. If you like, a Celestial Seasonings, multi-fruit tea, that's fine. If you want something more aromatic, a jasmine, that's good too. But as long as it's a green tea. And if nothing else, once the tea, and you should never drink any liquid hot, instead drink it lukewarm, then open up a capsule of green tea, 400 milligrams of green tea, and stir it in. That's giving you some phenomenally important polyphenols and phenola compounds that can help protect your cells, kill cancer cells, stimulate your immune system, and specifically stimulate the anti-cancer part of your immune system. Then, before dinner, this is an important thing. Always before dinner, about an hour before dinner, have yourself a glass of grapefruit juice and put in some vitamin C. What that will do is two things. One, it reduces your appetite, so you'll eat less at dinner and hence not overeat. And also, it has specific nutrients in it that can help kill bacteria and parasites in your intestine. So that's all good. So those are some ways of getting that extra liquid into our body in a day in a good way. Now, if you've had trouble with fertility and if you're a couple working on having a child but haven't been able to, the Mediterranean diet increases fertility. And this is the latest study, and this was in the peer-reviewed journal Fertility and Sterility, and it says the following. I'll just quote the beginning of this. It says, women who eat a Mediterranean-style diet, high in fruits and vegetables, fish, and whole grains, are less likely to have trouble getting pregnant. The findings add to a growing body of evidence linking the Mediterranean diet to all kinds of health effects, including lowering the risk of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. So that's important. And this was done on a whole lot of people to look at this. So, I mean, go to the Mediterranean. If you've never been there, it's really worth being there. First, the cultures are wonderful. And just go clear up. Remember, there's two Mediterraneans. There is the West Mediterranean, like Greece and Spain and Italy, Sicily, and France. And then there's the Eastern Mediterranean. Those are the old Eastern European bloc nations. And then there's the Southern Mediterranean, those that border going into the cove bordering towards Africa. So you've got over 28 nations involved in the Mediterranean. We only think of a few. The big difference is that on the Western Mediterranean, they're very big on fish. On the Eastern Mediterranean, they're big on pork and heavier meats, and they tend to be overweight, and they don't live as long. The Eastern Mediterranean live long, and the longest lived people in the world, as an island or as a small group of people, are on the island of Crete. and they actually live longer than the people on Formosa and Okinawa, living longer. And they live longer, even though they're Japanese descent, than those living in Japan. But as a large nation, Japanese live 10 years longer and much healthier, with less disease than those in the United States or in England. So what are these people on Crete doing that allows them to be the longest-lived people in the world? That wasn't always true. There was a time when the longest-lived people were in the Hunza Cuts in Hunza. And I was invited by the emir, the ruler of Hunza, through his two sons, to come there and help them with what was going to be happening in the mid-70s, where China was going to make a road right through the country and to spoil this beautiful, pristine, lost horizon group of people that were descendants of Alexander the Great's generals and who abandoned the army and went to hide there, and then grew this whole culture, thousands of people. In any case, they were living long, long lives, longest without question in the world. In fact, Hilton's book, Lost Horizon, which was a movie, was based upon this group of people. They had no jails. They had no currency. You couldn't get married till you were over 30. You had men and women who were vigorous in riding horses. These are these small, very strong horses, after 100 years of age. So they were unique. All of our efforts failed, and the culture was finally, for all intents and purposes, destroyed, because the Pakistanis came in with it, came in their venereal diseases, then came in their cheap products, and then people no longer did fasting. There was a time in Hunza where you couldn't eat if you ran out of your food until the new crops came in the spring. So sometimes they said they went 3 to 4 weeks on fasting. But they were very vigorous, and their food was a high substantial amount of raw food and nuts and seeds. In any case, in Crete, one of the reasons they live a long life, it's actually three reasons. One, because nobody ever sells anything there. They stay forever in their homes, and they're passed down generation to generation to generation. It's considered, almost like in Lebanon, it's almost considered a sin to sell your home to outsiders, because that's where you've always lived for hundreds of years. And so the sense of community and family are really important, and the older you get, the more important you are. You are the wise person, the wise woman, the wise man, the wise council of elders, and that has an enormous impact upon the decisions made. They're very vigorous. They're always walking and biking. And third, they take as long as the Italians take to eat, about 3 hours. They eat in small portions. If you've ever eaten Crete, you get small dishes, not big ones, and one at a time, not everything slopped on a plate. And they have very little food in their cupboards or in their refrigerators, as they believe in fresh, and they go out each day, fresh bread each day, fresh fish that day. Purslane. You've never seen this amount of purslane in your life eaten. Purslane is delicious, especially when it's just right, ready to eat. It's crisp and a little tart, a slightly lemonish quality. In fact, I like it with lemon juice and olive oil on it. But they eat a tremendous amount of it. Then when you start looking at the phytonutrient content and the antioxidant ore content of purslane, it's very high. Lots of dried fruits. Lots of fresh fruits. So that's one of the reasons they live the longest life. Now, one more reason for the grapefruit, and this is from the McClatchy Tribune News Service, Lauren House. She says, consumed either half a grapefruit 3 times a day before every meal, lost an average of 3.6 pounds after 3 months. And they talked about the grapefruit essential oils banishing the blues. If extracted carefully, a ton of the fruit produces 1.5 pounds of oil suitable for aromatic purposes. Cheerfully invigorating, energetic, and even slightly euphoric, grapefruit essential oil can help banish the blues. Also, apply grapefruit to the skin to rid of acne. And when applied to the skin, grapefruit extract simultaneously stimulates, purifies, and packs a naturally powerful antiseptic punch against even the most pesky pimples. Well, all that, of course, is true. What I would add is contains caprylic acid. And caprylic acid is one of the single most important things you can take when traveling or eating out, because it can help kill parasites. One more reason to have that glass of grapefruit juice before a meal. It lowers your appetite. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to share information that empowers us. And everyone is invited to participate. Now, this is the latest on the flu. First, 9 months ago, I began to do extensive research on vaccines. I wanted to see if we could definitively answer four questions. Are they safe? Are they effective? Are they not safe? Are they not effective? And what was the criteria, using only independent scientific studies? The evidence is in. It is overwhelming. It's not even close. Vaccines have never been proven safe nor effective under gold standards. Now, they have approximately 22 studies that are double-blind, placebo-controlled studies. And that's what they promote. Here's what they've never done. The only way to know if a vaccine works is to take one ingredient at a time and give that one pertussis to 1,000 people, exclude no one, and then take 1,000 cross-match people for age, body weight, and ethnicity, and sex, and who have never been vaccinated. You follow them on 3-month cycles of complete biochemical analysis and see after 6 years what the results are. It's never been done. And because it's never been done, what they do in their double-blind studies is they give a vaccine to people who have already been vaccinated, and it's a different type of vaccine that they're comparing it to. So they're comparing one vaccine to another. That's an already completely flawed scientific basis. So there are no good studies. Secondly, we see constantly the results of people getting sick, dying, hospitalized, autism, and other conditions. And yet they have the power. And because they have the power, they have the authority to produce the laws and control the media. So I'm doing a 5-part series, original in-depth investigative reports, then independently verified, vetted, and fact-checked by a PhD or an MD. The first three have now been released. They're on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com's face page, plus all the other articles on vaccines there in addition. The latest two just went up this week. The Safety of Vaccines, a 37-page article with over almost 100 footnotes showing you they're not safe. Then a shorter piece on flu vaccine and why I challenge its safety and efficacy. This just came in. This is the latest. Quote, the most widely used flu vaccine in the United States is only about 60% effective in healthy adults. That vaccine is the trivalent inactivated vaccine, which accounts for 90% of the flu shots in this country. This according to an article in the current issue of The Lancet Infectious Diseases. Now, so we were told that it's completely effective. Now we're told it's only 60% effective. Well, which 60%? That means 40% of the people, if it indeed did work, and I challenge the 60%, because they have no authentic way to know. For example, they're assuming, they're taking this on blind faith, that if 1,000 people took the vaccine and 600 of them didn't get the flu, that it was because of the vaccine that they didn't get the flu. They're not looking at a person's natural diet, supplements, anything else that would keep the person's immune system strong. So there, it's all supposition. It's all projected subjective mathematical models. On the other hand, it would be no different than if I gave 1,000 people vitamin C and 600 of them did not get a cold. I could not say that the reason you didn't get a cold was because you took the vitamin C. It may or may not have been a factor. So this is all lack of good science. But now they're even acknowledging what we've been stating all along. It is not effective. When you're off by 40%, then you're dealing in absolute fraud. You just might as well flip a coin. And then also, that's with healthy people. What about all the unhealthy people? How about just regular people who are overweight? You're no longer healthy. Well, that's 68% of the American population. How about people with cancer, heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, arthritis? Well, then in a test, you wouldn't be allowed the vaccine. Well, if you're not allowed the vaccine, but now you're taking it, Are those a part of the people? Then they were excluded. So then if you took everyone into account, you're not dealing with 60%. You might be dealing with 10%, which means that it's not effective at all. So what you're dealing with is completely fraudulent study that they acknowledge is not effective. That's the latest. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break, come back, and we're going to have our guests with us. And just an idea, think about this for a moment. This is from the Boritz News Service, and it's worth thinking about. This is a special offer from America's corporations, inviting you to share in the American dream. Dear American, American corporations have taken a beating recently. We've been accused of everything from buying elections to subverting the Constitution to being puppet masters at the Supreme Court. To these charges, we say, well, duh. As a wise man once said, corporations are people. Therefore, to be treated like a person in America today, it stands to reason you must become a corporation. That's why, for a limited time, we are offering every man, woman, and child in this country a chance to incorporate and become a card-carrying member of Corporation of American Corporations. Now, as a newly formed corporation, you will immediately reap the benefits that such other members as the Koch brothers enjoy in Goldman Sachs. You're exempt from federal, state, and local taxes. You'll never pay any more taxes. You have freedom to pollute America's air, water, and bird life, and you'll never be held accountable. And an exclusive opportunity to sell weapons to Iran and other countries. You can be an active part of every civil conflict and war in the world. So join us, won't you? Wire the Corporation of American Corporations a payment of $10,000 and start enjoying the rights and privileges that U.S. Constitution used to grant to ordinary individuals. Don't pass up on this amazing offer. We promise you it's too big to fail. Sincerely, the Corporation of American Corporations. Back in a moment. Stay with us. Our guest on the phone right now is Professor Roderick Tremblay. He is a prominent Canadian economist. He is now a prominent professor emeritus at the University of Montreal. And in the late 1970s, he served as the Minister of Industry and Commerce in the Quebec government. And he is an author, including The Code of Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles, which addresses the urgent need for a new sense of morals in the face of immense international and global challenges. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to talk to you, Dr. Knoll.
I'm going to begin by reading a brief article that is, then I would like for you to address it, all right?
Yes.
Greece on the Brink of Social Explosion is the title of the article. And here's what it says. This is written by Matthias Tometskaki. While surfing online last week, I stumbled on a blog post that describes the life of a 37-year-old woman in Athens in these days of crisis. Unfortunately, it is indicative of the condition in which so many gradually have entered as time under Troika and the International Monetary Fund's rescue policy passes. Here is an excerpt. I have worked since I was 16, and I have lived in Athens since I was 24. I'm now 37. I remember that many times I had to struggle in order to survive with two jobs, but never have I stayed unemployed for too long. During the past 8 years, there were times when things were tight and difficult, and other times when things were more or less okay. But not even in the most difficult period of my life as a university student did I find myself in the position I am today. For 13 years, I struggled. I fought, I stood on my feet, but now I can't take any more. I'm giving up. I've been unemployed for 10 months. Knowing that I was going to lose my job, I started searching for a new one from as early as Easter 2010. By now, I've sent 155 curriculum vitaes, but only got two replies back, both saying they didn't need any employees. For the first time in my life, I'm facing an eviction order by the end of this month. The landlord says that I have no dignity and that I live it on her expense, forgetting the 8 years that I've been meeting my obligations regularly or even the improvements I've made to her house on my own expenses. Still, she is right. There is no charity. She wants her money. The movers asked 1,200 euros to take my stuff back to my mother's city, or 150 a month, in order to store them in a container. I cannot afford either of the two scenarios. I will probably have to throw away my household of 10 years. The tax service is demanding 300 euros as an emergency levy with a 3% interest for every month I don't pay. Another emergency tax is expected with the next electric bill, and that's going to be an additional 420 euros. I have to pay 640 euros every 2 months for Social Security, although the company I work for explicitly told me that they have no job to offer, and that even if they did, they would pay a monthly salary of no more than 420 euros. In short, the city in which I have lived, Athens, for 13 years, is spitting me off to the margins like if I'm some kind of trash. For the first time in my life, I have no place to stay and no one to hold on to. Any stock of patience and courage I had has vanished. Even more impressive than the post just quoted, by the way, are the accompanying comments. They do not express empathy or offer help either. They may actually do what they identify with the narrative and contribute different variations of the same story, transforming it into an open wall of despair. Greece is at the tipping point. Although warnings of social decay and consequent explosion have been sounding since a long time ago, there are strong indications that the moment of realization is coming with dizzying speeds. Suicide rates, one of the classic variables in sociology that measures the health of a society, are the highest in Europe and have been rising dramatically since 2007. Only a few days ago, a man set himself on fire outside of a bank in the center of Athens in order to protest debt and unemployment, a story that was never reported in the evening news anywhere on television. But the pictures of the event have gone viral online. A recently rumored health problems due to starvation among pupils in primary schools of Athens shocked the Greek society. Unemployment reached officially 20%, pushing 1 million people, one out of five, but a lot more among youth and women, to insecurity and poverty, and compressing the total labor cost further downward. So that's the story. Now, here is my question to open our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Because this one question, you will be able to segue from point to point to point to point. This is interlocking. It's what is known as an intellectual coupling issue, meaning one part of it will connect with another part.
Yes.
All right, here's my issue. I see Greece right now as being the most vulnerable city in the world as a flashpoint. There are others that are poor. There are others where there's social chaos. But Greece is a part of the European Union. There are 27 nations in the European Union, 17 of which are on their currency, and others like England that don't use their currency but are part. But we were told today that Greece is going to be bailed out and given a temporary tranche of $8 billion, but they have to have another $100 billion within the next 6 months. This means that Greece's debt is now will be over 220% of their gross domestic product. For people in the audience, it means for every dollar of income that comes in, they will have $2.20 in expenses. The economy is going down. People are not going to Greece anymore because the basic social services of picking up garbage, providing safety, lights working, electricity working, those can no longer be taken for granted. They're all in disrepair. Now, the only way that the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and along with them Germany and France, agreed to this bailout is if that the bond investors agreed to a larger loss percentage, but all the banks made whole, meaning the banks who are guaranteeing this money will get 100 cents on the dollar if Greece goes belly up. They can say that with confidence, and the stock market today is probably going to reach 300 or higher, because in America we're saying Greece is bailed out, all is good, European Union is stable, let's all go back to business as usual. And I'm saying the Federal Reserve gave $16 trillion secretly out, including to governments and banks in Europe, in the Eurozone. It will not allow any of the big banks to fail. It will not allow any of the major corporations to fail. It gives them this money at 0.25% interest, which is zero interest. So now, on the one hand, the people who are allegedly bailing out Greece are giving money that they don't have to lose. It'll be the American taxpayer, because the Federal Reserve will be the last resort of money. The European Central Bank could do this, but the Eurozone cannot do it. The banks in the Eurozone cannot do it. So now, here's what I see. I see not the youth, because they're disorganized and they're now into a state of anarchy. I do see the unions coming forward and leading multiple general strikes. They just had a two-day strike last week. I believe that those two-day strikes are going to be becoming more and more frequently. And now they're telling the Greek people, we're taking away 20% of your pensions now, no more free education, no more free food, no more free medicine, and we're going to privatize a lot of these assets, because that's part of the deal. A chain of islands we've privatized, suddenly you're going to have a billionaire resort there. Whole monument areas are going to be privatized. The water will be privatized. The electricity will be privatized. The highways will be privatized. So now the Greeks are going to get clobbered by having to pay for things that historically were part of their social contract that they paid through with their taxes. I see that there will be a tipping point. It is inevitable. It is absolutely impossible for this not to happen. Sooner or later, when you keep taking blood from a person, there's a moment where they realize that the next blood could be their end, or they fight back and take that and stuff it right in your mouth. So I believe that Greek people will fight back in the next 12 months, and they'll come with absolute no more peaceful protests. They'll burn down buildings. There'll be assassinations. It's going to be absolute chaos in Greece, primarily because they're going to destroy the government so they can get a new government in its place. They're going to go out of the Eurozone. They'll stop all debt payment, much like Argentina did. That will cause the European banks to be made whole by the tune of $500 billion. But more importantly, I believe that Italy is standing by at an enormous debt, $2.7 trillion. France behind that at $1.8 trillion. Spain behind that at nearly $2 trillion. And Ireland. So you have five other nations cumulatively that could bring $6 trillion in unfunded, underfunded debt into this whole mix. That's even more than the Fed would be willing to bail out, because the American public would say, no, you're not helping us and you're going to help these people. You're helping the bankers. I believe that this is going to lead to a worldwide crisis. I believe that what we're seeing in the streets today, as important as it is for people to get angry and get out in the street, it's much like Howard Beale in the movie Network, where he said, go to the window, stick your head out the window and say, I'm sick and tired and I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. That's fine. In that moment, it lets people hear other people realizing you're all sharing a common anger. It does nothing whatsoever to change anything. That requires a whole other dynamic of social organizing and political action and unifying energies. That's not happening. But the people in America who are most likely to cause their next major social change will not be pacifists, will not be students. They will be the poor employed. How many of them are there? 65 million. They're all armed. They don't care about going out and marching. You're going to push them so far one day that they're going to snap. And it'll be one single instant. And when it happens, I wouldn't want to be a police officer. I wouldn't want to be anyone wearing a badge. I wouldn't want to be anyone in the military. I wouldn't want to be a congressman, because they're not going to take prisoners. These people, I'm out there. These people are pissed. You don't hear a thing about them. It's like they're invisible. And they're aware that you don't hear anything about them, and they have no advocates, no one's helping them. But you piss 65 million people off. You keep pushing them down until they can't even afford their homes. They're under mortgage. Their kids can't go to school. They're getting calls by people threatening, you know, that if you don't pay this bill, they have no place else to go, that they're in their rope. What do you think the likely outcome of someone, and now say 65 million someone, you just keep kicking them in the face, even in America, where we've become a punk-ass bunch of cowards, we're not standing up to authority, we're not throwing these bastards out in the street, we're trying to do everything very diplomatically. And that's exactly what the corporations are counting upon, because they can marginalize you the moment you raise your voice, the moment you get angry, the moment your anger becomes defiant, suddenly you're no longer legitimately angry. You're one of those hard-headed nut jobs. And I'm saying we're about to explode. I see it within the next 3 years, and then social anarchy and social chaos. That's the big picture. Take your time. The rest of the forum is yours to give your input on this, sir.
Well, Dr. Nell, the big picture that you paint is very bleak. As a matter of fact, my blog is called The Big Picture. Well, of course, Greece is the tip of the iceberg. As you mentioned, there are many other countries much larger than Greece. Italy is one, which has a debt which is five times the Greek debt. And you have Spain, you have Portugal, you have Ireland. So the politicians in Europe are trying to put their fingers into the dike in order to prevent the dam from financial dam from blowing up. But I think that it's a bit like putting lipsticks on a pig. You know, it's the financial crisis is still there. It was a man-made crisis. It's not a natural event. It's a man-made disaster. We have been in it now for 4 years, since 2007. I even wrote a blog saying that we probably will go down the way Japan did in the 1990, from 2007 to 2017, where we're going to have stagflation. That means economic stagnation and inflation, because the price of oil is still very high, and we see that prices, the inflation is high, even if the interest rates that people receive on their savings is very low, meaning that the real interest rate is negative, that therefore less income is coming from that part. And it all boils down to how the financial system has been engineered over the last 10 years, especially over the 5 or 6 years, in a sense that everything is frozen. And when governments and corporations or consumers take a lot of debt, and many of them took too much debt, and we know why in the case of Greece, you know, they were within the Euro Monetary Union, and they thought that they were protected from capital flight, and they took much too much debt. In the past, when the government had too much debt, it happened to Russia in 1998 and other countries, Thailand in 1999, they used to restructure the debt, cut the debt by half or less, and the banks will take the loss, and that will be the end of the story. Of course, investors or share owners in the bank will be in the banks will be losing money. But then the government will be relieved of that odious debt, or too large a debt. And it happened, as you mentioned, to Argentina. After 10 years of trying to cling to a strong currency, the U.S. dollar at that time, and in 2001, they devalued and they took back their peso, which is worth about 30 cents, 33 cents nowadays, and the same thing should happen with Greece. Of course, they cannot afford to have big debt because they are in economic depression. Or the GDP has been declining at the rate of 5% for the last 2 years, so they are really in a depression. You mentioned the plight of the young workers. Even I receive letters from young Greeks telling me that they want to migrate and try to find jobs elsewhere, and they want to come to the U.S. or Canada or elsewhere. But even here, you know, we have a high unemployment. Therefore, the euro is much too strong for these, for many of these countries, because the euro is really the Dutch mark disguised into a European currency. It's all right for Germany, which is a very productive economy, but for the remote economies like Portugal and Greece, it's much too strong. And the debt now the problem, the debt has become a hot potato to know who is going to be left with the hot potato. And everywhere it seems it will be the taxpayers, because in Europe they have that stabilization fund, which will be financed certainly by taxpayers. And now we learn that European countries are going to go to China with their hat in hand and try to borrow money from China, the Chinese, of course, who have been saving a lot of money over the last 10 or 12 years. It's very humiliating for the Europeans to go to the Chinese and try to ask them to solve their problems. The same thing with the U.S. Of course, the U.S. is borrowing a lot of money from China, Saudi Arabia, and other surplus countries. And therefore, by having the financial system being frozen as it is today, and not attacking the root of the problem, we know the root of the problem. They invented new artificial financial entities like the what we call the SDS, that insurance swap system that was invented to insure the banks against loss of default on the bonds they were buying from sovereign countries. These instruments, these toxic financial instruments, should have been at least, at the very least, very curtailed, because they became casino chips in the hands of speculators. As you know, a bank can issue SDS insurance chips on a bond at a rate which is much higher than the value of the bond which is insured. It's just like taking an insurance, a life insurance, on somebody who is going to be murdered and trying to profit from that insurance. For example, on the Greek debt, you could find maybe five or six times the insurance value on the bonds. And, of course, nobody can pay that. And this happened in the United States with AIG, the American International Group.
But Professor Tremblay,
which received $85 billion from Treasury Harry Paulson in 2008 in order to pay the banks on the insurance that they took against default for their loans to other banks or other entities. And you have the same problem that the U.S. went through in 2008 now happening in Europe on a larger scale, in a sense. And that's what's frightening if it keeps going for many years. I think Europe is already in a recession. I think they have begun being in recession. And that would spill over, of course, in North America and the U.S. and Canada.
Okay, two things. When it came to AIG and the money that went from TARP into AIG, the Timothy Geithner, who at that time was the head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, encouraged Goldman Sachs, his former alumni, to get 100 cents on the dollar from AIG, which was $12 billion, on money that they never invested. So they didn't lose a nickel, and they got $12 billion. At the same time, not a single home was stopped from being foreclosed on, and not a single corporation was stopped from being outshored to other countries. So the game is rigged. There's currently $600 trillion in credit default swaps and derivative positions out there, way beyond, as you say, sometimes 100 times more value in the gamble that something's going to fail. Goldman Sachs, I was told, had $400 billion riding on Greece defaulting. So if they default, they make money. And so you have these stupid things. I believe that we should let all these major corporations fail and go through structured bankruptcy. I believe we should let all the banks fail. I don't believe another bank should be bailed out at all. I believe that the investors in the bank should lose their money. If you're going to make money on the upside of investment, be there to make your loss on the downside. I don't believe we should bail anything out anymore. I don't believe in any more subsidies to corporate America at all. That in itself would mean that then we'd be more responsible and have savings and loan, or better still, credit unions, where we should be putting our money. If Americans started to take their money out of these companies and take their money out of the stock market and put it in savings, into safe investments and at least legitimate investments like a Bank of North Dakota and a state-owned bank or a credit union, then we would be really challenging the dominance of this corporate economic model. Even the figures we got about the economy rose by 3.5%, that's a myth. That was the financial sector leading that growth. So they're championing, oh, happy days are here again for you, because all you do is you're the parasite that lives off the host. And the American public have been the host. We are going down further into a recession, not getting out of it if you're the average person. 250 million Americans are not doing well. 245 are not doing well. And about 70 million are. So we look at the ones that are doing well and say, happy days are here. But what about all the people that are eating cat food? What about all the people living in the woods? I just filmed people living in the woods. I just filmed a family of four who are living in their car in the woods. Why in the woods? Because it's the only safe place that they're not going to get robbed or beaten up. Why? Because the police hassle you if you're in the city limits. But if you're on a street someplace, people will hassle you. For some reason, we're angry at people being poor. In fact, I just filmed a mayor who was a part of a movement to get churches, ministers, social workers, and any nonprofit charity that was feeding or the poor in a public park to be arrested, meaning the church members would be arrested. Could you imagine arresting people coming to give some food to homeless people and cleaning up after them and helping them? Because the community didn't want these poor people in their park. But it's everyone's park. Well, that's not what's happening. So we're not looking at 911. Let's get over this whole myth, this politically contemptible idea that we've got 1% of bad people and 99% of good people, and 99% are suffering and 1% are not. That is a myth, and it's an embarrassment. It's intellectual conceit. We have a lot of people who are miserable, selfish, self-absorbed, and now in one place where I filmed, who would have believed? I wouldn't have believed that the people would have demanded the police arrest people from churches feeding the poor. So I talked with the people from the churches. I went to the church. I spoke with the minister. If I feed a poor person in this park, I will be arrested. Any member of my congregation feeding people will be arrested. So now we're arresting people in the United States for feeding the poor. Well, which percentage of the 99.1 are they on? Those are not rich people telling, arrest these people. And everywhere I go, I see a contempt for losing what you have in life by people who still have something, as if there's a fear contagion, a possession contagion, a fear of loss contagion. So I'm not willing to live in these kind of altered realities because it's a political euphoria. Everyone's in the streets. Well, show me what's going to happen 2 years from now from being in the streets unless you have some really concrete direction and discipline that you bring to it. Ah, discipline's not in the equation. Ah, leadership's not in the equation. Ah. So we can all be against something, but as long as we yell it, somehow it's going to change. Not going to happen. I'm just very disappointed by what I'm seeing. I just filmed in a 55 people separately living in tents. They have no electricity. They have no water. They have no food. And there's a minister who's out there living in an old school bus, helping keep it all together. And he does family counseling and psychological counseling. And then he goes out each day and tries to get him food. And the day I got there to film, the city had just come in and torn down any structure they had that actually stored food or had a stove in it, because it wasn't in the ordinances. So I said, winter's coming. And the people said, yeah. And I said, well, all you have is tents. The tent won't hold out the cold. And you can't put a stove in a wooden stove or anything. But we had buildings, and there it was. And the city tore it down. Why would the city tear it down? Because the community. What community? There's not a shelter in the community, and there's 600,000 people in the county. A county that doesn't have a shelter, but is resentful for people living quietly and neatly, and nonviolently in the woods, and these weren't vets, these were just normal people, why would you be angry at these people? Why would you want to take someone who's down and make their life more miserable? Because they could call the city and go to the police and say, we want these people out of our woods. But this is a public wood. It's not private property. They're not hurting anyone. They're people who had jobs just like you. They were suffering. Can't you give them a break? They're not bothering anybody. You don't see them. You don't hear from them. They're organized. There's a minister there. They have a little religious group each day, all different denominations. They're trying to hold it together. So now you go in there and you take the only thing that can protect them in the wintertime, a little shed that had a stove in it, and you tear it down. This is what your bureaucracy means. So which side of the 1 in 99 are they on? There are times when I'm on this station, it's such in contempt. Anyhow, we'll get our side stated, because I'm doing a documentary and I'm doing a 52-part series on this, 52 1 hours, to show the truth that there's not 1 in 99. There's a whole lot of bad people on both sides and some good people on both sides. And unless we understand that if we're not even willing in America to help the average family, the average kids, there are kids there. How can you? Well, I went knocking on doors, but nobody would come out and talk with me. So I just stood there and filmed, hoping they'd show their face or come out. Because I got to find out about why a whole city council and the mayor and the police won't even allow church members to feed homeless people in an organized fashion, where they showed me they clean up. Everything's left just as nice as it was when they got there. All they're doing is helping people in need. Oh, and there were 35 homeless kids. We haven't talked about that yet in America, have we? 35 homeless children in just one shelter area, and there's no place for them to sleep. They're sleeping in the woods. Kids. Young kids sleeping in the woods, because there's no shelter in the community, and they can't stay in the parks, and they can't hang out around any public place because the police tell them to get away. Which side of the... who in their right mind would tell a young kid who has nothing, is homeless, go away? No food, no clothes, nothing. We don't want to see you. It'll make us feel uncomfortable in our neighborhood. That's exactly what I filmed. I filmed the children. I filmed the neighborhoods. I filmed the mayor. I filmed the authorities. And they're not in that 1%. They're in the 99%. Better get our figures straight and give it a little more accuracy and nuance in what we're really dealing with in America. It's not just a corporatocracy. It is a decline in moral values. It's a decline in spiritual values. It is a rush to the bottom. And look at television, look at radio, look at print, look at the celebrities, and you'll see what has contributed. I'll give you the final word, sir.
Well, what you're describing is a return to the 1930s, when there were hordes of unemployed people roaming around with no help, hardly any help. And as Santana said, if you don't know... your history, you're bound to repeat it, and I'm afraid we are repeating the same mistakes. We let the financial system crush the economy, and we don't solve the real problem. And as long as we don't solve the financial problem, people will keep losing their houses, keep losing their jobs, and that will be a spiral, economic spiral downwards. And I'm very worried about what's happening here in the United States and in Europe, because a lot of people are suffering, especially the young. And you need politicians of a high caliber now to challenge the masters, the financial masters, and change the rules. If we can only tax the taxpayers to salvage the bankers, you don't solve the problem. You just make it worse, and you load the taxpayers and the governments with debt, more debt, and that's what will crush even more the real economy. We need real solutions and not artificial solutions.
Professor Rodrigue Tremblay, a professor emeritus at the University of Montreal, former government minister and author of The Code of Global Ethics, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, good luck to your show and good luck to the people who suffer.
Well, I'm out there for another 58 days filming and traveling town to town across America and bringing their stories to the public's attention. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all very much for listening. Now stay tuned for Mike Fader, one of the most popular voices in radio because he brings unique perspective.
City Studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.